I'd like to introduce our guest, Dr. Glenn Barger. This is his fourth visit with us, I believe. But just to review, he has a psychotherapy practice in New York City. And pretty soon now we'll get back to my early childhood, and then we won't need him anymore. No, I'm just kidding. It's truly a great pleasure to have him back to share his insights into our nature as it's nurtured. Dr. Barger, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Michael. It's always a pleasure.
First off, it's wonderful to have you back. I'm hopeful that with just a few more visits, all my anxiety will be resolved.
Oh, that should happen hopefully in the next 5 or 10 seconds.
I know folks can be cynical about therapy. There's lots of therapy jokes, for instance. But when I visit your site, to me at least,
yes,
you are so focused on helping people. What is it about that that appeals to you?
Well, to tell you the truth, I've lived a life where I've done some good things and I've done some bad things. And I got to a certain point in my life where I recognized that when I did good things, I felt good about myself. And when I did bad things, I felt bad about myself. And I came to a decision where I preferred to feel good about myself and to feel good about life. And I thought that that was really what the universe or nature wants us to do. Nature wants us to be happy and feel good about ourselves. And the best way to do that, I think, is to help other people, is to give back when we've received such an amazing gift of life. Aristotle talked about this. He said that there's a difference between self-love and selfishness. And when you're self-loving, you live a life of goodness, of giving to other people. And that's the best way to love yourself.
You talk about treating traumatic experiences with EMDR. What is EMDR?
EMDR has a fascinating history. A woman named Dr. Francine Shapiro, sometime in the 90s, was walking through a park in San Francisco, and she was thinking about this memory that always bothered her when she thought about it. And for some reason, her eyes were moving back and forth. Maybe she was watching a tennis game. I'm not exactly sure how this came about. And she noticed that this memory that always upset her suddenly wasn't so upsetting. And she was a doctoral student at the time in psychology. And she started asking friends and colleagues, she said, do me a favor, think of something that always bothers you when you think about it and move your eyes back and forth. And she got a very similar result. So she created this lovely protocol and went to the Veterans Hospital where people were suffering from PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. These were people who'd been in war and were having a series of symptoms, flashbacks, anxiety, bad dreams, startle response, the kinds of things that maybe are in the news now with soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And she used this technique where people moved their eyes back and forth while they thought of the bad thing that happened to them. And she got phenomenal results curing PTSD in a way that nothing ever had. This was the beginning of EMDR. We say EMDR, that's short for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. But basically, it's the idea is that when you go through a terrible experience, it's as if that emotional experience does not get digested by your nervous system. And this is a method whereby it frees up that sort of psychological digestion process and you can integrate it so it doesn't disturb you in the present the way it might if it went untreated.
Well, also on another subject for treating ADD, there is, I'm not sure if I should say this or spell it out, FOESEA.
This is an idea that I came up with. I'm a student of attention deficit disorder, and I work with a number of people who have symptoms that would fit under that profile. But I don't like the notion of a diagnosis. I'm not a big fan of diagnoses in general because I believe that every human being is unique, that we all have a combination of attributes that makes us who we are, and those things vary over time and place, depending on circumstances. And I didn't like the idea of ADD being something you either had or didn't have. We all have our own way of focusing, of organizing, and people don't like to be put in those boxes anyway. So I came up with this concept of FOC, and each one of those letters stands for a human attribute, and the FOESEA stand for focus, organization, executive functioning, social interaction, esteem regulation, and affect regulation. So we all land somewhere on a spectrum of how focused we can be, how organized we are, how well we make decisions, how we interact with other people, how we feel about ourselves, and what our moods are like. And I do a kind of a detective process with people where I ask them a series of questions, and we kind of make a graph of where they land on this continuum. And that way, each person gets to see themselves as a unique individual rather than as an on or an off person. And then we can deal with those issues on an individual basis.
Certainly, it must be adaptable to children. Kids seem to get diagnosed with this.
Yeah, I have a book that's called The 132 Cures for ADD. And what that means is that we don't really understand this thing. We know that it exists. This has been reported for thousands of years. And certainly in dealing with children who struggle with issues of focus and organization, their struggles are real. And we need to acknowledge that, and we need to treat that when it's appropriate in the appropriate ways. ADD is both underdiagnosed and not recognized when it should be. It's also overdiagnosed. In my opinion, all too many children are medicated for that and other things when there might be more efficacious ways of treating and helping kids with these problems without resorting right away to medication.
What makes it so difficult to take those first steps to healing whatever troubles us? We mostly know what's wrong, it seems. We just can't convince ourselves to take action.
Most people come into therapy, if we wanted to reduce it to a sentence, to exactly that, where they say, I know what I should be doing. Why aren't I doing it? That's one of the great mysteries of humankind. We know what to do. We just don't do it. As I like to say, take my advice, I won't be using it. to say that I know the certain answer to that would be arrogant on my part, because it is one of the great mysteries. But I do have some ideas about it. First of all, on an obvious level, it's because people are afraid. People are afraid of the unknown. People are afraid to try. They're afraid to try because they might fail. I think underneath that fear is shame.
That's what I was going to say. Is there a mechanism that's at work that you can zero in on and just flip the switch, kind of thing?
I don't know if there's a mechanism where you can flip the switch, but I think the underlying cause is basically a bad feeling about ourselves.
Right.
And that's what I define shame as. It's not I did something wrong, but I am something wrong. It's an underlying feeling that there's something wrong with me.
Right.
And it's that feeling that leads us to not have the confidence, let's say, that we can overcome a particular obstacle.
But you also blog about the great sages of our time. This may be a dumb question, but why do we need or even want sages?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is that there's this human need to express the nature of the universe and human nature. And we find that the universe is expressed through humanity and through the nature outside of us. And we have this need to put that into words and to pass that legacy, what we discover, to pass that legacy on to others. And that's what we call culture. And it is this accumulation of wisdom that we call culture that is the universe getting to know itself.
Do you have a top five? Do you have any opinions on top five sages?
Well, I have my favorites, and certainly Carl Jung as a psychotherapist. Carl Jung, I believe, was a very brilliant guy, and he's not the easiest person to read, but I would recommend him. Ralph Waldo Emerson, for the young folks out there looking for something that can be inspiring. His essay on self-reliance, I think, is a classic that everybody should read. Mm-hmm. I am partial to Confucius and his disciple Mencius, mm-hmm. Who I believe were extraordinary humanists and had a wisdom that is timeless and mm-hmm. is as important today as it ever would be. And one of my favorites for my generation is John Lennon, who said, "All you need is love," and I don't think that you need to say much more than that.
Yeah.
I would like to see all the great minds who are working in psychotherapy right now to come together to see if we could find a basic method that could be applicable to as many people as possible. I wish that therapy was more available to more people. I don't even think we've begun to tap into the potentials that are available through technology that can make therapy more accessible, less expensive, and more available to larger and larger numbers of people.
Well, are you making progress in your quest to help heal us?
Well, Martha Graham, who invented modern dance, wrote to her student, Agnes DeMille, who was a great choreographer, and she said, "There is no satisfaction whatsoever at any time. There's only a queer divine dissatisfaction that keeps us working to improve all the time." And so I'm always striving to do better. I always know that I can do better. I try to make, and some people will say that the best psychotherapeutic technique is when the therapist is working on themselves. So I commit myself and I devote myself to self-discovery and self-healing, and I continue that process slowly, and I make incremental progress with that, and I hope that with that work that I am a better therapist every day.
Well, Glenn, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. But thanks for stopping by. As always, I really enjoyed it.
I always enjoy speaking with you, Michael. Thanks for having me on.